That which you will hear is imperfect and fragmented, yet treasure it, for without you it does not exist. I give you now a memory that has been forgotten, hidden in the dreamy haze that lies behind us. His keen eyes inspected their interested faces. His gaze lingered on Aragorn last of all. Before your grandfather's fathers were born, and yea, even before their fathers, the Dragon Riders were formed. To protect and guard was their mission, and for thousands of years they succeeded. Their prowess in battle was unmatched, for each had the strength of 10 men. They were immortal unless blade or poison took them. For good only were their powers used, and under their tutelage tall cities and towers were built out of the living stone. While they kept peace, the land flourished. It was a golden time. The elves were our allies, the dwarves our friends. Wealth flowed into our cities, and men prospered. But weep, for it could not last. Brom looked down silently. Infinite sadness resonated in his voice. Though no enemy could destroy them, they could not guard against themselves. And it came to pass, at the height of their power, that a boy, Galbatorix by name, was born in the province of Inzilbeth, which is no more. At 10 he was tested, as was the custom, and it was found that great power resided in him. The riders accepted him as their own. Through their training he passed, exceeding all others in skill. Gifted with a sharp mind and strong body, he quickly took his place among the riders' ranks. Some saw his abrupt rise as dangerous and warned the others, but the riders had grown arrogant in their power and ignored caution. Alas, sorrow was conceived that day. So it was that soon after his training was finished, Galbatorix took a reckless trip with 2 friends. Far north they flew, night and day, and passed into the Urgal's remaining territory, foolishly thinking their new powers would protect them. There, on a thick sheet of ice, unmelted even in summer, they were ambushed in their sleep. Though his friends and their dragons were butchered and he suffered great wounds, Galbatorix slew his attackers. Tragically, during the fight, a stray arrow pierced his dragon's heart. Without the arts to save her, she died in his arms. Then were the seeds of madness planted. The storyteller clasped his hands and looked around slowly, shadows flickering across his worn face. The next words came like the mournful toll of a requiem. Alone, bereft of much of his strength and half mad with loss, Galbatorix wandered without hope in that desolate land, seeking death. It did not come to him, though he threw himself without fear against any living thing. Urgals and other monsters soon fled from his haunted form. During this time, he came to realize that the riders might grant him another dragon. Driven by this thought, he began the arduous journey on foot back through the spine. Territory he had soared over effortlessly on a dragon's back now took him months to traverse. He could hunt with magic, but oftentimes he walked in places where animals did not travel. Thus, when his feet finally left the mountains, he was close to death. A farmer found him collapsed in the mud and summoned the riders. Unconscious, he was taken to their holdings, and his body healed. He slept for 4 days. Upon awakening, he gave no sign of his fevered mind. When he was brought before a council convened to judge him, Galbatorix demanded another dragon. The desperation of the request revealed his dementia, and the council saw him for what he truly was. Denied his hope, Galbatorix, through the twisted mirror of his madness, came to believe it was the rider's fault his dragon had died. Night after night he brooded on that, and formulated a plan to exact revenge. Brom's words dropped to a mesmerizing whisper. He found a sympathetic rider, and there his insidious words took root. By persistent reasoning and the use of dark secrets learned from a shade, he inflamed the rider against their elders. Together they treacherously lured and killed an elder. When the foul deed was done, Galbatorix turned on his ally and slaughtered him without warning. The riders found him then with blood dripping from his hands. A scream tore from his lips and he fled into the night. As he was cunning in his madness, they could not find him. For years he hid in wastelands like a hunted animal, always watching for pursuers. His atrocity was not forgotten, but over time searches ceased. Then, through some ill fortune, he met a young rider, Morzan, strong of body but weak of mind. Galbatorix convinced Morzan to leave a gate unbolted in the citadel, Illyria, which is now called Urubane. Through this gate Galbatorix entered and stole a dragon hatchling. He and his new disciple hid themselves in an evil place where the riders dare not venture. There Morzan entered into a dark apprenticeship, learning secrets and forbidden magic that should never have been revealed. When his instruction was finished, and Galbatorix's black dragon Shruken was fully grown, Galbatorix revealed himself to the world with Morzan at his side. Together they fought any rider they met. With each kill their strength grew. 12 of the riders joined Galbatorix out of desire for power and revenge against perceived wrongs. Those 12 with Morzan became the 13 Forsworn. The riders were unprepared and fell beneath the onslaught. The elves, too, fought bitterly against Galbatorix, but they were overthrown and forced to flee to their secret places, from whence they come no more. Only Vrail, leader of the riders, could resist Galbatorix and the Forsworn. Ancient and wise, he struggled to save what he could and keep the last remaining dragons from falling to his enemies. In the last battle, before the gates of Doru Arriba, Vrail defeated Galbatorix, but hesitated with the final blow. Galbatorix seized the moment and smote him in the side. Grievously wounded, Vrail fled to Utgard Mountain, where he hoped to gather strength. But it was not to be, for Galbatorix found him. As they fought, Galbatorix kicked Vrail in the fork of his legs. With that underhanded blow he gained dominance over Vrail and removed his head with a blazing sword. Then, as power rushed through his veins, Galbatorix anointed himself king over all Alagasia. And from that day he has ruled us. With the completion of the story, Brom shuffled away with the troubadours. Aragorn thought he saw a tear shining on his cheek. People murmured quietly to each other as they departed. Garrow said to Aragorn and Rohan, "Consider yourselves fortunate. I have heard this tale only twice in my life. If the Empire knew that Brom had recited it, he would not live to see a new month." Fate's Gift. The evening after their return from Carver Hall, Aragorn decided to test the stone as Murlock had. Alone in his room, he set it on his bed and laid 3 tools next to it. He started with a wooden mallet and lightly tapped the stone. It produced a subtle ringing. Satisfied, he picked up the next tool, a heavy leather hammer. A mournful peal reverberated when it struck. Lastly, he pounded a small chisel against it. The metal did not chip or scratch the stone, but it produced the clearest sound yet. As the final note died away, he thought he heard a faint squeak. Murlock said the stone was hollow. There could be something of value inside. "I don't know how to open it, though. There must have been a good reason for someone to shape it, but whoever sent the stone into the spine hasn't taken the trouble to retrieve it, or doesn't know where it is. But I don't believe that a magician with enough power to transport the stone wouldn't be able to find it again. So was I meant to have it? He could not answer the question. Resigned to an unsolvable mystery, he picked up the tools and returned the stone to its shelf. That night, he was abruptly roused from sleep. He listened carefully. All was quiet. Uneasy, he slid his hand under the mattress and grasped his knife. He waited a few minutes, then slowly sank back to sleep. A squeak pierced the silence, tearing him back to wakefulness. He rolled out of bed and yanked the knife from its sheath. Fumbling with a tinderbox, he lit a candle. The door to his room was closed. Though the squeak was too loud for a mouse or a rat, he still checked under the bed. Nothing. He sat on the edge of the mattress and rubbed the sleep from his eyes. Another squeak filled the air, and he started violently. Where was the noise coming from? Nothing could be in the floor or walls. They were solid wood. The same went for his bed, and he would have noticed if anything had crawled into his straw mattress during the night. His eyes settled on the stone. He took it off the shelf and absently cradled it as he studied the room. A squeak rang in his ears and reverberated through his fingers. It came from the stone. The stone had given him nothing but frustration and anger, and now it would not even let him sleep. It ignored his furious glare and sat solidly, occasionally peeping. Then it gave one very loud squeak and fell silent. Aragorn warily put it away and got back under the sheets. Whatever secret the stone held, it would have to wait until morning. The moon was shining through his window when he woke again. The stone was rocking rapidly on the shelf, knocking against the wall. It was bathed in cool moonlight that bleached its surface. Aragorn jumped out of bed, knife in hand. The motion stopped, but he remained tense. Then the stone started squeaking and rocking faster than ever. With an oath, he began dressing. He did not care how valuable the stone might be. He was going to take it far away and bury it. The rocking stopped. The stone became quiet. It quivered, then rolled forward and dropped onto the floor with a loud thump. He inched toward the door in alarm as the stone wobbled toward him. Suddenly, a crack appeared on the stone. Then another, and another. Transfixed, Aragorn leaned forward, still holding the knife. At the top of the stone, where all the cracks met, a small piece wobbled as if it were balanced on something, then rose and toppled to the floor. After another series of squeaks, a small dark head poked out of the hole, followed by a weirdly angled body. Aragorn gripped the knife tighter and held very still. Soon the creature was all the way out of the stone. It stayed in place for a moment, then skittered into the moonlight. Aragorn recoiled in shock. Standing in front of him, licking off the membrane that encased it, was a dragon. Awakening. The dragon was no longer than his forearm, yet it was dignified and noble. Its scales were deep sapphire blue, the same color as the stone. But not a stone, he realized, an egg. The dragon fanned its wings. They were what had made it appear so contorted. The wings were several times longer than its body, and ribbed with thin fingers of bone that extended from the wing's front edge, forming a line of widely spaced talons. The dragon's head was roughly triangular. Two diminutive white fangs curved down out of its upper jaw. They looked very sharp. Its claws were also white, like polished ivory, and slightly serrated on the inside curve. A line of small spikes ran down the creature's spine from the base of its head to the tip of its tail. A hollow where its neck and shoulders joined created a larger-than-normal gap between the spikes. Aragorn shifted slightly, and the dragon's head snapped around. Hard, ice-blue eyes fixed on him. He kept very still. It might be a formidable enemy if it decided to attack. The dragon lost interest in Aragorn and awkwardly explored the room, squealing as it bumped into a wall or furniture. With a flutter of wings, it leapt onto the bed and crawled to his pillow, squeaking. Its mouth was open pitifully, like a young bird's, displaying rows of pointed teeth. Aragorn sat cautiously on the end of the bed. The dragon smelled his hand, nibbled his sleeve. He pulled his arm back. A smile tugged at Aragorn's lips as he looked at the small creature. Tentatively, he reached out with his right hand and touched its flank. A blast of icy energy surged into his hand and raced up his arm, burning in his veins like liquid fire. He fell back with a wild cry. An iron clang filled his ears and he heard a soundless scream of rage. Every part of his body seared with pain. He struggled to move, but was unable to. After what seemed like hours, warmth seeped back into his limbs, leaving them tingling. Shivering uncontrollably, he pushed himself upright. His hand was numb, his fingers paralyzed. Alarmed, he watched as the middle of his palm shimmered and formed a diffused white oval. The skin itched and burned like a spider bite. His heart pounded frantically. Aragorn blinked, trying to understand what had occurred. Something brushed against his consciousness, like a finger trailing over his skin. He felt it again, but this time it solidified into a tendril of thought through which he could feel a growing curiosity. It was as if an invisible wall surrounding his thoughts had fallen away, and he was now free to reach out with his mind. He was afraid that without anything to hold him back, he would float out of his body and be unable to return, becoming a spirit of the ether. Scared, he pulled away from the contact. The new sense vanished, as if he had closed his eyes. He glared suspiciously at the motionless dragon. A scaly leg scraped against his side and he jerked back, but the energy did not shock him again. Puzzled, he rubbed the dragon's head with his right hand. A light tingling ran up his arm. The dragon nuzzled him, arching its back like a cat. He slid a finger over its thin wing membranes. They felt like old parchment, velvety and warm, but still slightly damp. Hundreds of slender veins pulsed through them. Again, the tendril touched his mind, but this time instead of curiosity, he sensed an overpowering, ravenous hunger. He got up with a sigh. This was a dangerous animal, of that he was sure, yet it seemed so helpless, crawling on his bed, he could only wonder if there was any harm in keeping it. The dragon wailed in a reedy tone as it looked for food. Aragorn quickly scratched its head to keep it quiet. "I'll think about this later," he decided, and left the room, carefully closing the door. Returning with two strips of dried meat, he found the dragon sitting on the windowsill, watching the moon. He cut the meat into small squares and offered one to the dragon. It smelled the square cautiously, then jabbed its head forward like a snake and snatched the meat from his fingers, swallowing it whole with a peculiar jerk. The dragon prodded Aragorn's hand for more food. He fed it, careful to keep his fingers out of the way. By the time there was only one square left, the dragon's belly was bulging. He proffered the last piece. The dragon considered it for a moment, then lazily snapped it up. Done eating, it crawled onto his arm and curled against his chest. Then it snorted, a puff of dark smoke rising from its nostrils. Aragorn looked at it with wonder. Just when he thought the dragon was asleep, a low humming came from its vibrating throat. Gently he carried it to the bed and set it by his pillow. The dragon, eyes closed, wrapped its tail around the bedpost contentedly. Aragorn lay next to it, flexing his hand in the near darkness. He faced a painful dilemma. By raising a dragon, he could become a rider. Myths and stories about riders were treasured, and being one would automatically place him among those legends. However, if the Empire discovered the dragon, he and his family would be put to death unless he joined the king. No one could or would help them. The simplest solution was just to kill the dragon, but the idea was repugnant and he rejected it. Dragons were too revered for him to even consider that. "Besides, what could betray us?" he thought. "We live in a remote area and have done nothing to draw attention." The problem was convincing Garrow and Roran to let him keep the dragon. Neither of them would care to have a dragon around. "I could raise it in secret. In a month or two, it'll be too large for Garrow to get rid of. But will he accept it? Even if he does, can I get enough food for the dragon while it's hiding? It's no larger than a small cat, but it ate an entire handful of meat. I suppose it'll be able to hunt for itself eventually. But how long until then? Will it be able to survive the cold outside?" All the same, he wanted the dragon. The more he thought about it, the surer he was. However things might work out with Garrow, Aragorn would do everything he could to protect it. Determined, he fell asleep with the dragon cradled against him. When dawn came, the dragon was sitting atop his bedpost like an ancient sentinel welcoming the new day. Aragorn marveled at its color. He had never seen such a clear, hard blue. Its scales were like hundreds of small gemstones. He noticed that the white oval on his palm, where he had touched the dragon, had a silvery sheen. He hoped he could hide it by keeping his hands dirty. The dragon launched off the post and glided to the floor. Aragorn gingerly picked it up and left the quiet house, pausing to grab meat, several leather strips, and as many rags as he could carry. The crisp morning was beautiful. A fresh layer of snow covered the farm. He smiled as the small creature looked around with interest from the safety of his arms. Hurrying across the fields, he walked silently into the dark forest, searching for a safe place for the dragon to stay. Eventually, he found a rowan tree standing alone on a barren knoll, its branches snow-tipped grey fingers that reached toward the sky. He set the dragon down by the base of the trunk and shook the leather onto the ground. With a few deft movements, he made a noose and slipped it over the dragon's head as it explored the snowy clumps surrounding the tree. The leather was worn, but it would hold. He watched the dragon crawl around, then untied the noose from its neck and fashioned a makeshift harness for its legs so the dragon would not strangle itself. Next, he gathered an armful of sticks and built a crude hut high in the branches, layering the inside with rags and stashing the meat. Snow fell on his face as the tree swayed. He hung more rags over the front of the shelter to keep heat inside. Pleased, he surveyed his work. "Time to show you your new home," he said, and lifted the dragon up into the branches. It wriggled, trying to get free, then clambered into the hut where it ate a piece of meat, curled up, and blinked coyly at him. "You'll be fine as long as you stay in here," he instructed. The dragon blinked again. Sure that it had not understood him, Aragorn groped with his mind until he felt the dragon's consciousness. Again he had the terrible feeling of openness, of a space so large it pressed down on him like a heavy blanket. Summoning his strength, he focused on the dragon and tried to impress on it one idea. "Stay here." The dragon stopped moving and cocked its head at him. He pushed harder. "Stay here." A dim acknowledgement came tentatively through the link, but Aragorn wondered if it really understood. After all, it's only an animal. He retreated from the contact with relief and felt the safety of his own mind envelop him. Aragorn left the tree, casting glances backward. The dragon stuck its head out of the shelter and watched with large eyes as he left. After a hurried walk home, he sneaked back into his room to dispose of the egg fragments. He was sure Garrow and Roram would not notice the egg's absence. It had faded from their thoughts after they learned it could not be sold. When his family got up, Roram mentioned that he had heard some noises during the night, but to Aragorn's relief, did not pursue the issue. Aragorn's enthusiasm made the day go by quickly. The mark on his hand proved easy to hide, so he soon stopped worrying about it. Before long, he headed back to the Rowan, carrying sausages he had pilfered from the cellar. With apprehension, he approached the tree. Is the dragon able to survive outside in winter? His fears were groundless. The dragon was perched on a branch, gnawing on something between its front legs. It started squeaking excitedly when it saw him. He was pleased to see that it had remained in the tree, above the reach of large predators. As soon as he dropped the sausages at the base of the trunk, the dragon glided down. While it voraciously tore apart the food, Aragorn examined the shelter. All the meat he had left was gone, but the hut was intact, and tufts of feathers littered the floor. Good, it can get its own food. It struck him that he did not know if the dragon was a he or a she. He lifted and turned it over, ignoring its squeals of displeasure, but was unable to find any distinguishing marks. It seems like it won't give up any secrets without a struggle. He spent a long time with the dragon. He untied it, set it on his shoulder, and went to explore the woods. The snow-laden trees watched over them like solemn pillars of a great cathedral. In that isolation, Aragorn showed the dragon what he knew about the forest, not caring if it understood his meaning. It was the simple act of sharing that mattered. He talked to it continuously. The dragon gazed back at him with bright eyes, drinking in his words. For a while he just sat with it resting in his arms and watched it with wonder, still stunned by recent events. Aragorn started for home at sunset, conscious of two hard blue eyes drilling into his back, indignant at being left behind. That night he brooded about all the things that could happen to a small and unprotected animal. Thoughts of ice storms and vicious animals tormented him. It took hours for him to find sleep. His dreams were of foxes and black wolves tearing at the dragon with bloody teeth. In the sunrise glow, Aragorn ran from the house with food and scraps of cloth, extra insulation for the shelter. He found the dragon awake and safe, watching the sunrise from high in the tree. He fervently thanked all the gods, known and unknown. The dragon came down to the ground as he approached and leapt into his arms, huddling close to his chest. The cold had not harmed it, but it seemed frightened. A puff of dark smoke blew out of its nostrils. He stroked it comfortingly and sat with his back to the rowan, murmuring softly. He kept still as the dragon buried its head in his coat. After a while it crawled out of his embrace and onto his shoulder. He fed it, then wrapped the new rags around the hut. They played together for a time, but Aragorn had to return to the house before long. A smooth routine was quickly established. Every morning Aragorn ran out to the tree and gave the dragon breakfast before hurrying back. During the day he attacked his chores until they were finished and he could visit the dragon again. Both Garrow and Roran noted his behavior and asked why he spent so much time outside. Aragorn just shrugged and started checking to make sure he was not followed to the tree. After the first few days he stopped worrying that a mishap would befall the dragon. Its growth was explosive. It would soon be safe from most dangers. The dragon doubled in size in the first week. 4 days later it was as high as his knee. It no longer fit inside the hut in the rowan, so Aragorn was forced to build a hidden shelter on the ground. The task took him 3 days. When the dragon was a fortnight old, Aragorn was compelled to let it roam free because it needed so much food. The first time he untied it, only the force of his will kept it from following him back to the farm. Every time it tried, he pushed it away with his mind until it learned to avoid the house and its other inhabitants. And he impressed on the dragon the importance of hunting only in the spine, where there was less chance of being seen. Farmers would notice if game started disappearing from Palancar Valley. It made him feel both safer and uneasy when the dragon was so far away. The mental contact he shared with the dragon waxed stronger each day. He found that although it did not comprehend words, he could communicate with it through images or emotions. It was an imprecise method, however, and he was often misunderstood. The range at which they could touch each other's thoughts expanded rapidly. Soon Aragorn could contact the dragon anywhere within 3 leagues. He often did so, and the dragon in turn would lightly brush against his mind. These mute conversations filled his working hours. There was always a small part of him connected to the dragon, ignored at times, but never forgotten. When he talked with people, the contact was distracting, like a fly buzzing in his ear. As the dragon matured, its squeaks deepened to a roar, and the humming became a low rumble. Yet the dragon did not breathe fire, which concerned him. He had seen it blow smoke when it was upset, but there was never a hint of flame. When the month ended, Aragorn's elbow was level with the dragon's shoulder. In that brief span, it had transformed from a small, weak animal into a powerful beast. Its hard scales were as tough as chainmail armor, its teeth like daggers. Aragorn took long walks in the evening with the dragon padding beside him. When they found a clearing, he would settle against a tree and watch the dragon soar through the air. He loved to see it fly and regretted that it was not yet big enough to ride. He often sat beside the dragon and rubbed its neck, feeling sinews and corded muscles flex under his hands. Despite Aragorn's efforts, the forest around the farm filled with signs of the dragon's existence. It was impossible to erase all the huge four-clawed footprints sunk deep in the snow, and he refused even to try to hide the giant dung heaps that were becoming far too common. The dragon had rubbed against trees, stripping off the bark, and had sharpened its claws on dead logs, leaving gashes inches deep. If Garrow or Roran went too far beyond the farm's boundaries, they would discover the dragon. Aragorn could imagine no worse way for the truth to come out, so he decided to preempt it by explaining everything to them. He wanted to do 2 things first, though. Give the dragon a suitable name, and learn more about dragons in general. To that end, he needed to talk with Brom, master of epics and legends, the only places where dragon lore survived. So when Roran went to get a chisel repaired in Carver Hall, Aragorn volunteered to go with him. The evening before they left, Aragorn went to a small clearing in the forest and called the dragon with his mind. After a moment, he saw a fast-moving speck in the dusky sky. The dragon dived toward him, pulled up sharply, then leveled off above the trees. He heard a low-pitched whistle as air rushed over its wings. It banked slowly to his left and spiraled gently down to the ground. The dragon backflapped for balance with a deep, muffled thwomp as it landed. Aragorn opened his mind, still uncomfortable with the strange sensation, and told the dragon that he was leaving. It snorted with unease. He attempted to soothe it with a calming mental picture, but the dragon whipped its tail unsatisfied. He rested his hand on its shoulder and tried to radiate peace and serenity. Scales bumped under his fingers as he patted it gently. A single word ran in his head, deep and clear.
Aragorn.
It was solemn and sad, as if an unbreakable pact were being sealed. He stared at the dragon, and a cold tingle ran down his arm.
Aragorn.
A hard knot formed in his stomach as unfathomable sapphire eyes gazed back at him. For the first time, he did not think of the dragon as an animal. It was something else, something different. He raced home, trying to escape the dragon. My dragon.
Aragorn.
Tea for two. Rorand and Aragorn parted at the outskirts of Carvajal. Aragorn walked slowly to Brom's house, engrossed in his thoughts. He stopped at the doorstep and raised his hand to knock.
A voice rasped, "What do you want, boy?"
He whirled around. Behind him, Brom leaned on a twisted staff embellished with strange carvings. He wore a brown hooded robe like a friar. A pouch hung from the scuffed leather belt clasped round his waist. Above his white beard, a proud eagle nose hooked over his mouth and dominated his face. He peered at Aragorn with deep-set eyes shadowed by a gnarled brow, and waited for his reply. "To get information," Aragorn said. "Rohan is getting a chisel fixed, and I had free time, so I came to see if you could answer a few questions." The old man grunted and reached for the door. Aragorn noticed a gold ring on his right hand. Light glinted off a sapphire, highlighting a strange symbol carved on its face.
"You might as well come in. We'll be talking a while. Your questions never seem to end."
Inside, the house was darker than charcoal, an acrid smell heavy in the air.
"Now for a light."
Aragorn heard the old man move around, then a low curse as something crashed to the floor.
"Ah, here we go."
A white spark flashed. A flame wavered into existence. Brom stood with a candle before a stone fireplace. Stacks of books surrounded a high-backed, deeply carved wooden chair that faced the mantel. The four legs were shaped like eagle claws, and the seat and back were padded with leather embossed with a swirling rose pattern. A cluster of lesser chairs held piles of scrolls. Inkpots and pens were scattered across a writing desk.
"Make room for yourself. But by the Lost Kings, be careful. This stuff is valuable."
Aragorn stepped over pages of parchment covered with angular runes. He gently lifted crackling scrolls off a chair and placed them on the floor. A cloud of dust flew into the air as he sat. He stifled a sneeze. Brom bent down and lit the fire with his candle.
"Good. Nothing like sitting by a fire for conversation."
He threw back his hood to reveal hair that was not white, but silver, then hung a kettle over the flames and settled into the high-backed chair.
"Now what do you want?"
He addressed Aragorn roughly, but not unkindly. "Well," said Aragorn, wondering how best to approach the subject, "I keep hearing about the dragon riders and their supposed accomplishments. Most everyone seems to want them to return, but I've never heard tell of how they were started, where the dragons came from, or what made the riders special, aside from the dragons."
"A vast subject to tell about," grumbled Brom.
He peered at Aragorn alertly.
"If I told you their whole story, we would still be sitting here when winter comes again. It will have to be reduced to a manageable length. But before we start properly, I need my pipe."
Aragorn waited patiently as Brom tamped down the tobacco. He liked Brom. The old man was irascible at times, but he never seemed to mind taking time for Aragorn. Aragorn had once asked him where he came from, and Brom had laughed, saying,
"A village much like Carvajal, only not quite as interesting.
Curiosity aroused, Aragorn asked his uncle, but Garrow could only tell him that Brom had bought a house in Carvajal nearly 15 years ago and had lived there quietly ever since. Brom used a tinderbox to light the pipe. He puffed a few times, then said,
"There, we won't have to stop, except for the tea. Now, about the riders, or the Skjortagal, as they are called by the elves. Where to start? They spanned countless years, and at the height of their power held sway over twice the Empire's lands. Numerous stories have been told about them, most nonsense. If you believed everything said, you would expect them to have the powers of a lesser god. Scholars have devoted entire lives to separating these fictions from fact, but it's doubtful any of them will succeed. However, it isn't an impossible task if we confine ourselves to the three areas you specified: how the riders began, why they were so highly regarded, and where dragons came from. I shall start with the last item."
Aragorn settled back and listened to the man's mesmerizing voice.
"Dragons have no beginning, unless it lies with the creation of Alagaesia itself. And if they have an end, it will be when this world perishes, for they suffer as the land does. They, the dwarves and a few others, are the true inhabitants of this land. They lived here before all others, strong and proud in their elemental glory. Their world was unchanging until the first elves sailed over the sea on their silver ships."
"Where did the elves come from?" interrupted Aragorn. "And why are they called the Fair Folk? Do they really exist?"
Brom scowled. "Do you want your original questions answered or not? They won't be if you want to explore every obscure piece of knowledge."
"Sorry," said Aragorn. He dipped his head and tried to look contrite.
"No, you're not," said Brom, with some amusement.
He shifted his gaze to the fire and watched it lick the underside of the kettle.
"If you must know, elves are not legends, and they are called the Fair Folk because they are more graceful than any of the other races. They come from what they call Alaleia, though none but they know what or even where it is."
Now, he glared from under his bushy eyebrows to make sure there would be no more interruptions.
"The elves were a proud race then, and strong in magic. At first, they regarded dragons as mere animals. From that belief rose a deadly mistake. A brash elven youth hunted down a dragon as he would a stag and killed it. Outraged, the dragons ambushed and slaughtered the elf. Unfortunately, the bloodletting did not stop there. The dragons massed together and attacked the entire elven nation. Dismayed by the terrible misunderstanding, the elves tried to end the hostilities but couldn't find a way to communicate with the dragons. Thus, to greatly abbreviate a complicated series of occurrences, there was a very long and very bloody war, which both sides later regretted. At the beginning, the elves fought only to defend themselves, for they were reluctant to escalate the fighting. But the dragons' ferocity eventually forced them to attack for their own survival. This lasted for 5 years, and would have continued for much longer if an elf called Aragorn hadn't found a dragon egg."
Aragorn blinked in surprise.
"Ah, I see you didn't know of your namesake," said Brom.
"No." The tea kettle whistled stridently. "Why was I named after an elf?"
"Then you should find this all the more interesting," said Brom.
He hooked the kettle out of the fire and poured boiling water into two cups. Handing one to Aragorn, he warned,
"These leaves don't need to steep long, so drink it quickly before it gets too strong."
Aragorn tried a sip but scalded his tongue. Brom set his own cup aside and continued smoking the pipe.
"No one knows why that egg was abandoned. Some say the parents were killed in an elven attack. Others believe the dragons purposefully left it there. Either way, Aragorn saw the value of raising a friendly dragon. He cared for it secretly, and in the custom of the ancient language, named him Bid-Darm. When Bid-Darm had grown to a good size, they travelled together among the dragons and convinced them to live in peace with the elves.
treaties were formed between the two races. To ensure that war would never break out again, they decided that it was necessary to establish the Riders. At first, the Riders were intended merely as a means of communication between the elves and dragons. However, as time passed, their worth was recognized, and they were given ever more authority. Eventually, they took the island Vroengard for their home and built a city on it, Doru Arriba. Before Galbatorix overthrew them, the Riders held more power than all the kings in Alagaesia. Now I believe I have answered two of your questions.
Yes, said Aragorn absently. It seemed like an incredible coincidence that he had been named after the first rider. For some reason his name did not feel the same any more.
What does Aragorn mean?
I don't know, said Brom. It's very old. I doubt anyone remembers except the elves, and fortune would have to smile greatly before you talked with one. It is a good name to have, though. You should be proud of it. Not everyone has one so honorable.
Aragorn brushed the matter from his mind and focused on what he had learned from Brom.
There was something missing. I don't understand. Where were we when the Riders were created?
We?
Asked Brom, raising an eyebrow.
You know, all of us.
Aragorn waved his hands vaguely. Humans in general.
Brom laughed. We are no more native to this land than the elves. It took our ancestors another 3 centuries to arrive here and join the Riders.
That can't be, protested Aragorn. We've always lived in Palancar Valley.
That might be true for a few generations, but beyond that, no. It isn't even true for you, Aragorn, said Brom gently. Though you consider yourself part of Garrow's family, and rightly so, your sire was not from here. Ask around and you'll find many people who haven't been here that long. This valley is old and hasn't always belonged to us.
Aragorn scowled and gulped at the tea. It was still hot enough to burn his throat.
This was his home, regardless of who his father was. What happened to the dwarfs after the Riders were destroyed?
No one really knows. They fought with the Riders through the first few battles, but when it became clear Galbatorix was going to win, they sealed all the known entrances to their tunnels and disappeared underground. As far as I know, not one has been seen since.
And the dragons? He asked. What of them? Surely they weren't all killed?
Brom answered sorrowfully.
That is the greatest mystery in Alagaesia nowadays. How many dragons survived Galbatorix's murderous slaughter? He spared those who agreed to serve him, but only the twisted dragons of the Forsworn would assist his madness. If any dragons, aside from Shrukun, are still alive, they have hidden themselves so they will never be found by the Empire.
So where did my dragon come from? Wondered Aragorn.
Were the Urgals here when the elves came to Alagaesia? He asked.
No. They followed the elves across the sea like ticks seeking blood. They were one of the reasons the Riders became valued for their battle prowess and ability to keep the peace. Much can be learned from this history. It's a pity the king makes it a delicate subject, reflected Brom.
Yes, I heard your story the last time I was in town.
Story? Roared Brom.
Lightning flashed in his eyes.
If it is a story, then the rumors of my death are true, and you are speaking with a ghost. Respect the past. You never know how it may affect you.
Aragorn waited until Brom's face mellowed before he dared ask, How big were the dragons? A dark plume of smoke swirled above Brom like a miniature thunderstorm.
Larger than a house. Even the small ones had wingspans over 100 feet. They never stopped growing. Some of the ancient ones before the Empire killed them could have passed for large hills.
Dismay swept through Aragorn.
How can I hide my dragon in the years to come?
He raged silently, but kept his voice calm. When did they mature?
Well, said Brom, scratching his chin, they couldn't breathe fire until they were around 5 to 6 months old.
which was about when they could mate. The older a dragon was, the longer it could breathe fire. Some of them could keep at it for minutes. Brom blew a smoke ring and watched it float up to the ceiling.
I heard that their scales shone like gems.
Brom leaned forward and growled, You heard right. They came in every color and shade. It was said that a group of them looked like a living rainbow, constantly shifting and shimmering. But who told you that? Aragorn froze for a second, then lied,
A trader.
What was his name? Asked Brom. His tangled eyebrows met in a thick white line, the wrinkles deepened on his forehead. Unnoticed, the pipe smoldered out. Aragorn pretended to think.
I don't know. He was talking in Mourns, but I never found out who he was.
I wish you had, muttered Brom.
He also said a rider could hear his dragon's thoughts, said Aragorn quickly, hoping that the fictitious trader would protect him from suspicion.
Brom's eyes narrowed. Slowly he took out a tinderbox and struck the flint. Smoke rose, and he took a long pull from the pipe, exhaling slowly. In a flat voice he said,
He was wrong. It isn't in any of the stories, and I know them all. Did he say anything else?
Aragorn shrugged.
No.
Brom was too interested in the trader for him to continue the falsehood. Casually he inquired,
Did dragons live very long?
Brom did not respond at once. His chin sank to his chest while his fingers tapped the pipe thoughtfully, light reflecting off his ring.
Sorry, my mind was elsewhere. Yes, a dragon will live for quite a while, forever in fact, as long as it isn't killed and its rider doesn't die.
How does anyone know that? Objected Aragorn. If dragons die when their riders do, they could only live to be 60 or 70. You said during your narration that riders live for hundreds of years, but that's impossible.
It troubled him to think about living his family and friends. A quiet smile curled Brom's lips as he said slyly,
What is possible is subjective. Some would say that you cannot travel through the spine and live, yet you do. It is a matter of perspective. You must be very wise to know so much at such a young age.
Aragorn flushed, and the old man chuckled.
Don't be angry. You can't be expected to know such things. You forget that the dragons were magical. They affected everything around them in strange ways. The riders were closest to them and experienced this the most. The most common side effect was an extended life. Our king has lived long enough to make that apparent, but most people attribute it to his own magical abilities. There were also other, less noticeable changes. All the riders were stronger of body, keener of mind, and truer of sight than normal men. Along with this, a human rider would slowly acquire pointed ears, though they were never as prominent as an elf's.
Aragorn had to stop his hand from reaching up to feel the tips of his ears.
How else will this dragon change my life? Not only has it gotten inside my head, but it's altering my body as well.
Were dragons very smart?
Didn't you pay attention to what I told you earlier? Demanded Brom. How could the elves form agreements and peace treaties with dumb brutes? They were as intelligent as you or I.
But they were animals, persisted Aragorn.
Brom snorted.
They were no more animals than we are.
For some reason, people praise everything the riders did, yet ignore the dragons, assuming that they were nothing more than an exotic means to get from one town to another. They weren't. The riders' great deeds were only possible because of the dragons. How many men would draw their swords if they knew a giant fire-breathing lizard, one with more natural cunning and wisdom than even a king could hope for, would soon be there to stop the violence? Hmm? He blew another smoke ring, and watched it waft away.
Did you ever see one?
Nay, said Brom, it was long before my time.
And now for a name. I've been trying to recall the name of a certain dragon, but it keeps eluding me. I think I heard it when the traders were in Carverhall, but I'm not sure. Could he help me?
Brom shrugged and quickly listed a stream of names.
There was Jura, Hirador, and Fundor, who fought the giant sea snake. Galsra, Briam, Ohen the Strong, Gritium, Barone, Roslab.
he added many others. At the very end, he uttered so softly Aragorn almost did not hear, "And Saphira." Brom quietly emptied his pipe.
"Was it any of those?"
"I'm afraid not," said Aragorn. Brom had given him much to think about, and it was getting late. "Well, Roran's probably finished with Horst. I should get back, though I'd rather not."
Brom raised an eyebrow.
"What, is that it? I expected to be answering your questions until he came looking for you. No queries about dragon battle tactics or requests for descriptions of breathtaking aerial combat? Are we done?"
"For now," laughed Aragorn. "I learned what I wanted to, and more." He stood, and Brom followed.
"Very well, then."
He ushered Aragorn to the door.
"Goodbye. Take care. And don't forget, if you remember who that traitor was, tell me."
"I will, thank you." Aragorn stepped into the glaring winter sunlight, squinting. He slowly paced away, pondering what he had heard.
A Name of Power.
On the way home, Roran said, "There was a stranger from Therensford at Horst's today."
"What's his name?" asked Aragorn.
He sidestepped a patch of ice and continued walking at a brisk pace. His cheeks and eyes burned from the cold.
"Dempton. He came here to have Horst forge him some sockets," said Roran.
His stocky legs ploughed through a drift, clearing the way for Aragorn.
"Doesn't Therensford have its own smith?"
"Yes," replied Roran, "but he isn't skilled enough." He glanced at Aragorn. With a shrug, he added,
"Dempton needs the sockets for his mill. He's expanding it and offered me a job. If I accept, I'll leave with him when he picks up the sockets."
Millers worked all year. During winter, they ground whatever people brought them, but in harvest season they bought grain and sold it as flour. It was hard, dangerous work. Workers often lost fingers or hands to the giant millstones.
"Are you going to tell Garrow?" asked Aragorn.
"Yes."
A grimly amused smile played across Roran's face.
"What for? You know what he thinks about us going away. It'll only cause trouble if you say anything. Forget about it, so we can eat tonight's dinner in peace."
"I can't. I'm going to take the job."
Aragorn halted.
"Why?"
They faced each other, their breath visible in the air.
"I know money is hard to come by, but we always manage to survive. You don't have to leave."
"No, I don't. But the money is for myself." Roran tried to resume walking, but Aragorn refused to budge.
"What do you need it for?" he demanded.
Roran's shoulders straightened slightly.
"I want to marry."
Bewilderment and astonishment overwhelmed Aragorn. He remembered seeing Katrina and Roran kissing during the trader's visit, but marriage?
"Katrina?"
he asked weakly, just to confirm. Roran nodded.
"Have you asked her?"
"Not yet, but come spring, when I can raise a house, I will."
"There's too much work on the farm for you to leave now," protested Aragorn. "Wait until we're ready for planting."
"No," said Roran, laughing slightly. "Spring's the time I'll be needed the most. The ground will have to be furrowed and sown. The crops must be weeded, not to mention all the other chores. No, this is the best time for me to go, when all we really do is wait for the seasons to change. You and Garrow can make do without me. If all goes well, I'll soon be back working on the farm, with a wife."
Aragorn reluctantly conceded that Roran made sense. He shook his head, but whether with amazement or anger, he knew not.
"I guess I can only wish you the best of luck, but Garrow may take this with ill humour."
"We will see."
They resumed walking, the silence a barrier between them. Aragorn's heart was disturbed. It would take time before he could look upon this development with favour. When they arrived home, Roran did not tell Garrow of his plans, but Aragorn was sure that he soon would. Aragorn went to see the dragon for the first time since it had spoken to him. He approached apprehensively, aware now that it was an equal.
"Aragorn."
"Is that all you can say?" he snapped.
"Yes."
His eyes widened at the unexpected reply, and he sat down roughly.
"Now it has a sense of humour. What next?"
Impulsively, he broke a dead branch with his foot. Roran's announcement had put him in a foul mood. A questioning thought came from the dragon, so he told it what had happened. As he talked, his voice grew steadily louder until he was yelling pointlessly into the air. He ranted until his emotions were spent, then ineffectually punched the ground.
"I don't want him to go, that's all," he said helplessly.
The dragon watched him passively, listening and learning. Aragorn mumbled a few choice curses and rubbed his eyes. He looked at the dragon thoughtfully.
"You need a name. I heard some interesting ones today. Perhaps you'll like one."
He mentally ran through the list Brom had given him until he found two names that struck him as heroic, noble, and pleasing to the ear.
"What do you think of Vanilor, or his successor, Eridor? Both were great dragons."
"No," said the dragon.
It sounded amused with his efforts.
"Aragorn."
"That's my name. You can't have it," he said, rubbing his chin.
"Well, if you don't like those, there are others." He continued through the list, but the dragon rejected every one he proposed. It seemed to be laughing at something Aragorn did not understand, but he ignored it and kept suggesting names.
"There was Ingathold. He slew the..."
A revelation stopped him.
"That's the problem. I've been choosing male names. You are a she."
"Yes."
The dragon folded her wings smugly. Now that he knew what to look for, he came up with half a dozen names. He toyed with Miramel, but that did not fit. After all, it was the name of a brown dragon. Ophelia and Lenora were also discarded. He was about to give up when he remembered the last name Brom had muttered. Aragorn liked it, but would the dragon? He asked,
"Are you Saphira?"
She looked at him with intelligent eyes. Deep in his mind, he felt her satisfaction.
"Yes."
Something clicked in his head, and her voice echoed as if from a great distance. He grinned in response. Saphira started humming. A Miller-to-Be. The sun had set by the time dinner was served. A blustery wind howled outside, shaking the house. Aragorn eyed Roran closely and waited for the inevitable. "Finally, I was offered a job at Therensford's mill, which I plan to take." Garrow finished his mouthful of food with deliberate slowness and laid down his fork. He leaned back in his chair, then interlaced his fingers behind his head and uttered one dry word. "Why?" Roran explained, while Aragorn absently picked at his food.
"I see," was Garrow's only comment. He fell silent and stared at the ceiling. No one moved as they awaited his response. "Well, when do you leave?"
"What?" asked Roran.
Garrow leaned forward with a twinkle in his eye. "Did you think I would stop you? I'd hoped you would marry soon. It will be good to see this family growing again. Katrina will be lucky to have you."
Astonishment raced over Roran's face, then he settled into a relieved grin.
"So, when do you leave?" Garrow asked.
Roran regained his voice. "When Dempton returns to get the sockets for the mill."
Garrow nodded. "And that will be in..."
2 weeks."
"Good. That will give us time to prepare. It'll be different to have the house to ourselves. But if nothing goes amiss, it shouldn't be for too long."
He looked over the table and asked,
"Aragorn, did you know of this?"
He shrugged ruefully. "Not until today. It's madness."
Garrow ran a hand over his face. "It's life's natural course."
He pushed himself up from the chair.
"All will be fine. Time will settle everything. For now, though, let's clean the dishes."
Aragorn and Roran helped him in silence. The next few days were trying. Aragorn's temper was frayed. Except for curtly answering direct questions, he spoke with no one. There were small reminders everywhere that Roran was leaving. Garrow making him a pack, things missing from the walls, and a strange emptiness that filled the house. It was almost a week before he realized that distance had grown between Roran and him. When they spoke, the words did not come easily and their conversations were uncomfortable. Saphira was a balm for Aragorn's frustration. He could talk freely with her. His emotions were completely open to her mind, and she understood him better than anyone else. During the weeks before Roran's departure, she went through another growth spurt. She gained 12 inches at the shoulder, which was now higher than Aragorn's. He found that the small hollow where her neck joined her shoulders was a perfect place to sit. He often rested there in the evenings and scratched her neck while he explained the meanings of different words. Soon she understood everything he said and frequently commented on it.